podcast this week. It doesn't matter where you stand on the political spectrum, Jeff Goldblum is here to make everything okay. He's here to talk to us about Independence Day resurgence, plus there's usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I can't believe Sokovia voted to leave the EU. Hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, back in the hot seat after a brief trip to Europe to watch football, and welcome to the Empire podcast. This week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is a man who won't tell us if he voted remain or leave in the referendum to leave the planet of the apes. It's Dan Jolin.
Hello, Chris. It's a real honour to be in here. I do like being in the Empire podcast. And I just wish other people felt the same way.
Subtle. That's why we like it, Dan. You bring the subtlety. Which is saying something. Next up, last but not least, is a man who again won't tell us if he voted for Nicolas Cage to remain or leave the National Treasure franchise, but I'm guessing it was remain. It's Johnny Pyle.
Of course it was. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Good, yourself?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. We're not going to talk politics on the podcast this week. That's all you're going to get from us. Instead, we're going to go straight on to this week's question, which comes from Twitter. It comes from @FernFougere. I apologise if I'm mispronouncing that. Fern Fougere. Question for the Empire podcast. Having just watched episode 2 of Preacher, a show weirdly I still haven't seen, even though it's probably my favourite comic book of all time. What are the best church scenes, although not necessarily terrifically violent? Okay, that's a good one to get into. Church scenes?
Yeah, yeah. I've got one that isn't in any way violent.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, Blazing Saddles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Explain.
So it's the hymn that the townspeople are singing. So the bandits are coming and causing problems, and they sing this hymn. And it's killing me. I can't remember every single lyric, but it just ends with them singing, "Our town is turning into shit." the preacher in that particular congregation is great. It's very sort of old cynical preacher who rants at them. That particular hymn, that would be my vote for my favourite church scene.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
That's quite a good one. Any others? Johnny, what about you? What do you got?
Well, I mean, I assume I've been invited back on the podcast this week because of the finale to National Treasure, of course, set in the Old North Church in Boston.
Well, of course.
And of course, so for the last 20 minutes, they're in the church and underneath the church, then back in the church, and then Harvey Keitel's in the church, and it's just a wonderful thing. I mean, I don't know if you've been to the Old North Church in Boston.
I
certainly spent some time there in the game Fallout 4.
Okay. All right.
But it's a wonderful place, and all these catacombs below with various, I suppose, unintentional booby traps from the wearing of the wood over hundreds of years, but such a wonderful place to visit. And, of course, then the Templar's treasure was hidden there as well.
Of course it was.
Spoilers.
Of course it was. Well, pretty much any question that we get in the podcast will now be National Treasure. And that's
I will
your answer.
Absolutely, you do my best. Yeah,
yeah. In some way, I thought maybe you'd been to Boston. I've never been to Boston, so
I've been.
You've been.
Yeah.
Okay,
my brother's there now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not the Old North Church, but
what's he doing? What's he doing in Boston?
He went to see Cheers, the bar Cheers. It's like a cafe, I think.
Is he on holiday or is he living there?
No, he's on holiday.
He's on holiday. Okay. I thought he'd moved to Boston.
No.
It's like I thought you were like sending piles around the world to places where National Treasure took place, just to put your stamp down, plant your flag.
Right. Yeah.
In the ground.
I'm going to move to Mount Rushmore. I'm going
Absolutely.
To buy a bivouac and hang out under Lincoln's nose.
Bivouac. What a name. There's loads, isn't there? I mean, this is one of those great, you know, just all-encompassing questions. There's so many great church scenes over the years. You could have, well, Black Narcissus is one that springs to mind. Most recently, of course, Kingsman, The Secret Service, has the astonishingly violent church scene. He doesn't like that scene. I love that scene. I think it's an extraordinary action sequence.
Why don't you like that scene, Johnny?
I thought it was I thought they judged it poorly, the tone of it. I thought it was not a nice moment as they start to slaughter all these people.
Yes.
You're saying it might be a bit extreme and violent?
But they're bad people. It goes out of their way. The film goes out of its way to make sure that these are bad people who deserve the hell that is unleashed upon them in that sequence, which lasts about, I don't know, three and a half minutes, something like that. There's loads of great stuff. I mean, The Untouchables.
the, you know, you push a knife, you pull a gun. That conversation takes place in a church. That's a,
Highlander,
that's a great church sequence.
Highlander, where the Kurgan says that Jesus was a fool for giving up his power.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many great confession scenes over the years that take place in
so
churches.
So many confession scenes. I mean, too many.
Too many.
Too many.
Too many to list.
Yeah.
Says Dan. Can't think of one, can you?
Yeah, I can't think of a single one. But all I can think of Hail Caesar, okay, because that's recent, right? So give me that.
Calvary, which starts with an amazing confession scene.
That is a very good confession scene. You're absolutely right.
That's very, very good. I mean, obviously churches are sort of ripe for horror films. The End of the Fog takes place in a church. It's a siege in a church. And the very, very last shot takes place in a church. And it's just, there's something really ripe about that setting for horror movies. What's the other horror, another great horror film that takes place in a church?
Forward is at a funeral. A lot of that is in a church.
And that is the most horrifying film you've mentioned yet. So, yeah, I'd say that's
the climax of End of Days, where Gabriel Byrne turns into a full-sized demon and fights with Arnie. I think that's a forgotten average film.
Yeah. Oh, The Omen, where Patrick Troughton gets speared by the falling... pyre, is it a pyre in the church? The church gets hit by lightning and falls and stabs him right through, and then suddenly the storm and the tempest goes away. That's a great moment.
Godfather. The climax of The Godfather.
Godfather.
And The Graduate.
The Graduate. Yes. So many.
And therefore Wayne's World 2 as well.
Oh my God. The Killer. The Killer. The whole climax of The Killer takes place. Wayne's World 2. Oh my God, there's so many.
Bad Lieutenant. Another one with Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
In a church.
Yeah.
Doing terrible things.
Absolutely. This is amazing. It's too many. There's too many. So that's about... I think we listed about 16 there. There's loads. We haven't even mentioned High Noon.
Yes. Yep.
Another good one.
Where's the start of Face Off set where he's dressed as a vicar and then there's a choir there? Is that in a church or is that just a choir in a big space?
And it's always seemed to me to be just a choir in a big space, but why he's dressed as a priest is never... Is it never made clear? I'm not entirely sure it's made clear.
I mean, but potentially it's a church.
Yeah, potentially.
That's what churches are like in America.
It is a church. And doesn't the final showdown take place in a church as well? I think I'm pretty sure they meet up back in the church in Face Off. There's tons.
Yeah,
and
there's
tons.
A lovely circularity to the whole thing, really.
There really is. It's which is obviously intentional.
Of course.
They're good spaces, churches, though, aren't they? I mean, they're good dramatic spaces. You can see why they're cinematic. I mean, apart from the, some of those little kind of weird sort of modern ones that we have in this country where you sort of walk in and it feels a little bit just like a kind of town hall.
Johnny, you want to say something?
This is an awful moment for me because it's a national treasure faux pas.
Well, we're here. We're here with you, man. We got your back.
But something was niggling at me as I was talking about Boston and... the finale is not set in Boston. It's set in New York City.
See, I don't know National Treasure enough to pull you up on that.
It's set underneath Wall Street, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
He sends him to the old North Church in Boston as a trick to get rid of Sean Bean.
Right.
But, of course, I just feel terrible. And I should probably revoke my National Treasure's number one fan status. I'll have to
I don't think there's much competition for it, I'll be honest with you.
But someone has to take this baseball cap off me and this jacket.
You'll be turned away from the pearly Benjamin Gates when your time is up. Oh, man. This is such a shame. See, this is the thing. I just take whatever you say about National Treasure as gospel. I just automatically assume it's the truth.
Yeah, I feel someone should have picked me up on it.
Well, maybe I need to rewatch National Treasure and particularly National Treasure Book of Secrets because I think that's the real one. That's the underrated one, isn't it? I mean, that's the one that... Yeah, it got disparaged a little bit when it came out, but I've got a feeling it's probably the aliens to the first movie's Alien. So I'm looking forward to revisiting those.
I'm sure, yeah.
It should be fun.
Thanks, guys. I've got to go now.
Yeah. there are so many church scenes. I don't even know where to stop with this. But I think we've mentioned about 17 or 18. Obviously, we won't mention every single one. I've just been reminded about the beginning of Kill Bill Volume 2, for example. Or Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
Where Bruce Willis, the bad guys, led by William Sadler, they set a base in a disused church and... Bruce Willis ends up fighting meat from Porky's outside the church and stabs him in the eye with an icicle.
And there's a great disused church in Terry Gilliam's The Zero Theorem as well.
There you go.
Which it's worth seeing just for that set.
In fact, I would argue it's only worth seeing for that set. But I don't want to upset you, Dan. Not on this day.
Thank you.
Not on this day of all days.
Not today.
No, not
today. I'm a bit fragile. I may just leap over this table and bite your throat out.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Remain. Remain. Okay, if you want to get in touch with the Empire Podcast, we are on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Do use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can also email us, podcast@empireonline.com. And we're on Facebook as well, where we are Empire Magazine. Okay, so let's talk about the week's news. The week's movie news. The movie news. Dan, easy. Down. Down, boy. What's been happening?
Oh, not much.
Great.
No, it seems that the big news is there's been some revelations about Rogue One, but I think the one that's really excited people is the news that a certain Anakin Skywalker, aka Dark Lord of the Sith, mm-hmm. Darth Vader,
yes.
is going to be making an appearance in some form.
I've never heard of him.
I hope they call it. I hope it just like he turns up and goes, "All right, Anakin." People, just, you know, just, he's like, "Stop calling me that." It's Darth now.
Yeah. Who would be saying this to him?
Psychic people. People who have read the script.
Okay.
It does bother me in Star Wars when he gets called Darth what's his name? Ben Kenobi. That one.
Yes.
Calls him Darth. And yes. It became obvious after that that Darth became kind of, it was like the title, not the actual name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's weird. Why would, you know, maybe he was being a bit mocking or something. But yeah, anyway.
It's so, you know. Darth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I hope they don't have people in Rogue One going, "All right, Darth."
But he also calls him Vader. He goes, "Vader."
That's better. More respectful.
I don't know. Maybe he's just being quite formal when you meet someone in that world. Maybe it's like, a bit like saying, "You can't win, Lord," or "You can't win, Sir." Maybe
Doctor.
It's a bit like that. Doctor, Doctor, yes, that could be it.
Dr. Vader.
Yeah, Doctor, call him paging Dr. Vader. So that's interesting. And this this comes from a big EW story on Rogue One, which hit this week. And basically, if anyone thought that Darth Vader was being added to this movie as an afterthought, that piece makes it very clear that he wasn't, that they were actually filming tests on the set of The Force Awakens with Darth Vader, not the real Darth Vader, an actor playing Darth Vader, just to make sure that they get the lighting right, because it's very, very tricky to light him. So, you know, you get the feeling that sometimes these movies, not necessarily Star Wars, but other movies, occasionally Marvel, maybe the DC movies, do tend to wing it as they go along. But this is confirmation that Star Wars, they seem to be planning this one fairly, openly from the beginning. Yeah.
Sith just got real, man.
Sith just got real. What do you think, Johnny, of this? You excited about Vader's return?
Yeah, of course. I mean, anything Star Wars, I'd be first in line to see, assuming that James isn't going to see it, because if he is, then he'll be first in line.
Yeah.
And he knows karate.
Actually, he wasn't last time for Force Awakens. He wasn't first in line. Where was he? He was about 17th in line, something like that. Yeah.
And it still haunts him to this day.
It does haunt him to this day. He's not happy about it. He wasn't happy. Helen and I were ahead of him. We were behind loads of people.
He should redouble his efforts.
But that's cool. I mean, everything looks good. The character names that came out this week sound very, very good. Very Star Warsy. So we've known the cast for some while from Rogue One. We only knew Jyn Erso, Felicity Jones' character. But this week, others were announced, weren't they, Dan?
Yes, so we've got Chirrut Imwe.
Yep.
Who is played by Donnie Yen.
Yep.
So he's a blind kind of warrior monk kind of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not a Jedi, but inspired by a Jedi. So he doesn't have... He's not force sensitive, but he does Jedi monkey stuff.
So he has all the boringness of being a Jedi, but none of the actual magic.
Yes, there you go.
That seems to be
the life choice.
But maybe that boringness is balanced against his mate, who is called Baze Malbus. Let's just say that again.
Baze Malbus.
Baze together.
Baze Malbus. That's
his name Malbus. Is Baze Malbus. Yes.
James Arthur's.
Yes.
What? No. Baze no. Malbus.
Yes. Jiang Wen plays
yes.
him. Plays
okay.
him. And that's his kind of buddies. They're a kind of a double act.
Okay.
But that's not my favourite one. Not Baze Malbus. My favourite one is director Orson Krennic. Orson Krennic.
Oh my word.
It's kind of a name that you kind of it's like as you're saying it, you're kind of walking, and then as you get to Krennic, you kind of slide down into a pit of darkness and evil. Krennic.
He's a good guy then, yeah?
No, it's played by Ben Mendelsohn.
Ah, okay. Yes.
And he's got really, really white clothes.
He does, doesn't he?
Really white clothes. So I like him.
Orson Krennic. That's yes. a good name.
This
That's
is a very good name. We've got Captain Cassian Andor.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a bit more classic, I think, in terms of Star Wars. That's Diego Luna's character. He's the rebel officer. And then we've got, I mean, this sounds like it should be in a surfer movie, but anyway, Bodhi Rook.
Yes.
And what surfer movie do you mean?
Any surfer movie. I mean, you know, it's just a generic surfer movie name, right? I mean, there's no particular surfer movie. Someone called Bodhi would appear, right?
Is there? So it could be in, like, Blue Juice
or
like any of that stuff.
Yeah, right. Anything with blue in the title.
Yeah. Yep.
There was probably something in it called Bodhi. So that's Riz Ahmed.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a pilot, the pilot. We have Galen Erso, who is Jin's dad. Apparently, played by Mads Mikkelsen, the amazing Mads Mikkelsen, best cheekbones in the world, better than Johnny Depp's.
That's a big claim to make.
It is.
Wow.
Yep. You could slice bread with his cheekbones. And okay. I would.
So they're ridged.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you need a serrated edge, really, to get through bread.
I know. Oh, well, right. Maybe I could slice ham with his cheekbones. How about that?
Okay.
Would you maybe better? Okay. And then there's Actually, I'm not sure how to say this. K2SO, would you say? It's not K2SO, right?
No,
K2SO?
K2SO. K2SO.
Who, of course, is a droid.
Yes.
And he's interesting. This character's interesting. He's played by Alan Tudyk, who has played a robot before in iRobot.
Yes,
I think the idea with the K2SO, which I really like, is... So he's a security droid. So he's a bit more... He's not like C-3PO polite or R2-D2 plucky. He's more a kind of, he'll rip your arms off. He reminds me a bit of the character, I believe it's called HK-47. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going by memory here. In the game Knights of the Old Republic, who referred to all humans as meatbags and was a complete psychopath. So they probably won't go that far with K2SO, but I hope they do.
Wow.
I hope they do. And finally.
Yes.
Saw Gerrera.
Who's that?
Saw Gerrera.
Who's that?
That is... that's Forrest Whitaker's character. He is actually a character that's appeared before in the Star Wars, in Clone Wars.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
In an episode of Clone Wars he was from the fifth season. And he was fighting with against the Separatist army and was actually trained by Anakin Skywalker, a.k.a. Darth Vader. So there's actually some connection.
Oh, my word. So whenever they said, because earlier on I read that they weren't going to release Forrest Whitaker's name just yet because he'd be playing a character we've seen before, but in a different guise. And the reason for that is because he's not animated.
That's correct. He does look different to the animated character as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the animated character's got different coloured eyes for a start. But, you know, he's the same character. The character's got a scar, mm-hmm. and it's the same on the Forrest Whitaker's face.
Holy cow.
So, and...
It's all connected, man.
Yeah. Is this the first time... Actually, I'm trying to just thinking this through. Is this the first time that a character created for one of the animated series has now appeared in live-action form?
Boba Fett.
Ooh, good knowledge.
But I think he was created for Empire Strikes Back and then they did a cartoon.
Yeah, they did the thing for the holiday special.
You still don't know where Forrest Whitaker's character, you don't know what it was actually created for, right?
True. It's just his first appearance would have been in animated form.
Yeah.
So obviously there's other characters who exist in the films that have then appeared in animated
form.
But whether this is the first time in this universe it's happened that way around.
Kit Fisto?
Was he created by Gendy or Jindy Tartakovsky? Possibly. Oh, and actually, no. Grievous. General Grievous.
So most of them.
Yeah, General Grievous. All right, fine. There we go.
Aura Singh appears in the podcast race in Phantom Menace. And
right.
She was extended universe before. Okay. And she doesn't get any lines, but, you know. So occasionally the expanded universe, extended universe, which is now non-canon apart from Clone Wars and some books.
Yeah.
did bleed into the main films. But this is interesting. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. And presumably he's a way into Darth Vader's appearance as well. So, yeah. Okay, cool. That's good. And I love those names as well. I have to say those Star Wars names are fantastic because it's very, very difficult to do a good Star Wars name. I mean, there's the time-honored way of doing it. I've just Googled this. So apparently how you determine your Star Wars honorific name and title is... Let's see if we can all do this. And hey, you guys can play along at home as well. You take the last three letters of your last name and reverse them. So, Dan, you would be...
Mill.
Nil. Okay.
Yeah, I'm feeling that way today.
Johnny, you would be...
Eli.
Okay, this is good. And I would be... T. Okay. Then you add the name of the first car you drove or owned.
What?
So the first car I owned was a Ford Ka. So I'll go Ka. So I'm T Ka.
Nice.
And you're?
Eli VW Polo. Pistachio green.
I'll take Polo. Eli Polo. Okay, Dan?
Well, that makes me Nil Mini. That sucks.
Then you insert the word of, and then you tack on the name of the last medication you took.
What?
So I don't know what the last medication I took was because it was a painkiller in France. I'm just going to say...
L'aspirine.
Nurofen. Yeah, l'aspirine. Nurofen. So I'm TK of Nurofen. Johnny?
I have literally no idea.
Eli Polo of...
Come back to me and I'll think. I have no idea.
Just think. You never get sick, do you? Like the last son of Krypton.
I took a strong painkiller because I cracked my ribs.
Okay, that was probably ibuprofen.
No, it was like... I don't know. It began with a C. I don't know.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about. It's like cocaine or something like that. Or cocaine! That's what it is.
There it is.
No, what was it? It's codeine or something like that.
But it wasn't codeine. It was something more medical.
Okay, something more medical.
More NHS-y.
Eli Polo of something more NHS-y. And Dan?
Nil Mini of Symbicort.
That's pretty good.
What is a Symbicort?
Symbicort is a dry powder inhaler. It's my asthma medication.
Right.
Yeah.
You redeemed it there at the end. See, Nil Mini, I thought you were, you know, that could be a reference to...
It's because there's so much bad atmosphere in this country at the moment that I have to take asthma medication.
We're shutting it down. Films only. Films only. What else is happening in the world of film news? So Universal are also trying to establish their... shared universe of movie monsters. So they're filming The Mummy at the moment with Tom Cruise and Annabelle Wallace and Russell Crowe with Sofia Boutella in the title role. And now word reaches us this week that the Wolfman may be up next and they want Dwayne Johnson to somehow find time in his busy schedule to star in that movie.
How is that possible?
What do you mean, how is that possible?
How can he have time? Isn't he like, you know, like Doc Savage and Shazam and... whoever he is in Fast and Furious.
Jumanji and
the Jumanji man.
It's San Andreas 2 and all sorts of movies. And Central Intelligence, you know, that did pretty well at the box office. So it might be a sequel to that. So, it's ridiculous. But this is a man who gets up every day at 4 in the morning, which is stupid. I'm not even sure that time exists. And then has a full day. So he could probably film two films a day. Two complete films a day.
So actually what you're saying is... he's wasting a lot of his time because he's got nowhere near that many films coming out.
No, he should have. We should, next year, on a conservative estimate, we should have 700 to 800 films starring Dwayne Johnson. If he really pulled his finger out.
And where are they? Where are they, Dwayne?
Where are they?
Come right here and fight us.
Yeah. Start with Johnny, then go to Nil Mini of what was it?
Symbicort.
Symbicort. That's a great name. That's a bad guy organisation in a sci-fi movie. That's awesome. Yeah. Get through these two, and then I'll be waiting just to, you know, run as fast as I bloody can.
But if I was The Rock...
Yeah.
If I was Dwayne...
Yeah.
I'd be a bit wary of going back to Universal Monster franchises.
Yes.
Okay.
A good point.
Because look what they did to him not in The Scorpion King, in The Mummy Returns. Look what they did to him.
Look what they did. Look what they did to my boy.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. That just wasn't good.
One of the worst special effects in the history of movies.
And I've seen Die Another Day.
Same year, wasn't it?
I think so.
No, the year before. Yeah. Mummy Returns was 2001.
Bad era for CGI.
Bad days.
But yeah, I mean, maybe. But then again, I suppose then he did do the Scorpion King after that, so he wasn't that bothered.
Mm.
But hey, is that? I mean, he's a big fella. I mean, isn't it more interesting if the Wolfman's more of a normal kind of a person when they're not a werewolf?
Possibly. I don't know. I'm not running this franchise.
Yeah.
But yeah.
More's a pity, Chris.
I know. It would be awesome. Should we put a request out?
Yeah.
Say it now. Yeah. This is your moment.
Come on, Hollywood. You know what's what. Put me in charge. Yay! Every film is a remake of Event Horizon. All of a sudden, Sean Pertwee is in every single movie. That would be interesting. But yeah, so they're not touching Dracula right away, which I find intriguing.
That's quite recent, though, the last Dracula, right?
Yeah.
Well, so's the Wolfman.
Yeah.
I keep on saying Wolfman as though
it's the Wolfman.
Yeah. So's Wolfman. So, I still can't say it right.
The Wolfman.
The Wolfman. The Wolfman. The Wolfman. Yeah. There you go.
The Wolfmans live next door.
Yeah.
They're a lovely couple. Reg and Irene.
And Wolfman is Wolfman from Gladiators.
Yes, Wolfman.
So, yeah. Wolfman.
Wolfman. No.
Wolfman.
The Wolfman. The Wolfman, yeah. I don't know. That was very recent, you're right, the one with Benicio del Toro.
That wasn't that recent, right? But that wasn't that recent.
Dracula Untold. Dracula Untold.
Dracula.
Was not meant to be part of this. In fact, that film's colossal failure is one of the big reasons why I think they decided to try and do the shared universe of monsters, just like they did back in the old days. So,
but with Van Helsing.
With Van Helsing, just like they did back in 2004 with Van Helsing.
During that era of bad CG.
But again, don't you feel this is a little example of maybe running before you can walk? I mean, you've got The Mummy, you've got Tom Cruise, you've got Russell Crowe. It's probably going to be a big, big film. But don't you want to wait to see what happens to that film before you go down the line with a sequel or a second installment in that franchise that people may not want?
I mean, I think it's fine to like do some like forward planning, but don't announce it to everyone.
Yeah.
Because then you look daft.
You do.
Should it go wrong, which I don't think it will.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Cruise, I think, actually rarely makes bad films.
Yeah. Yeah. He's on a very, very solid streak. And in fact, this week, this is relevant to our interests, the trailer for Jack Reacher Never Go Back came out, directed by Ed Zwick. And in fact, next week in Empire, the new issue of Empire, which hits next Thursday, you can see an exclusive image from the film in the pages of Empire, and also read Ed Zwick talking about the film for the first time, which is very, very intriguing. But yeah, Jack Reacher Never Go Back, the trailer came out this week. I really liked it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's solid stuff. I mean, I'm hopeful for the film. This seems to me, I mean, as much as I really liked Chris McQuarrie's take, this seems to me to be a bit more confident about who Reacher is so far in this take on it. He's a man who doesn't say very much. He's much more of a puncher in this one. He's much more of a one-man army in the trailer, certainly, so to speak. And Kobe Smulders' character, Susan Turner, who teams up with him throughout the course of the movie, calls him Reacher and not Jack. Nobody did that in the first movie, but I just think that's a nice bit of the Reacher mythology.
Yeah, I mean, it's the book is very different, actually. Well, it's not very different. I mean, let's not go crazy here. It's not War and Peace to Killing Floor, but
yeah,
you know, One Shot was very much a set in one location, and it was a mystery story about one. But this is very much Reacher doing what Reacher now does, which is a bit of a journey, bit of punching, more journeying, have some coffee. More punching, and you know, it's very much made to be an action film in the way that possibly One Shot isn't, because you've got so much plot to get through in One Shot.
Absolutely. And of course, the interesting thing about One Shot as well is that it's one of the very, very, very few books, and I know this, and you know this, having read the entire Reacher canon a couple of times at least. I did a reread recently, where Reacher doesn't, how can I put this delicately?
Make
the sweet love to the sweet ladies. I thought that was very interesting, introducing a sort of, in One Shot, introducing a sort of asexual Reacher, someone who, you know, who was very much focused on the task in hand rather than the, you know, the task in both hands. And I thought that was an interesting way to go. And this way, in this movie, clearly he and Kobe Smulders will be getting some smouldering tension going.
Will they?
Yeah, they will.
Okay.
They will, I'm sure. They do in the book. So how did we get onto that? Oh yeah, Tom Cruise, The Mummy. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, and I'm looking forward to Jack Reacher Never Goes Back, and I'm also looking forward to a movie that was announced this week. It's called, very simply, Mom and Dad. It's directed by Brian Taylor, who's one half of the Maniacs, who directed the Crank films. So there's Mark Nebeldy and Brian Taylor. They've both gone their separate ways, creatively speaking, at least for now. They've obviously worked, Brian Taylor's worked with Nick Cage before, so he and Selma Blair will star in this movie about a teenage girl and a little brother, not played by Selma Blair and Nick Cage, who have to survive an onslaught from their parents when for some reason their parents become psychopaths for 24 hours. So that sounds like a cool, fun, balls-out horror film premise to me. And Nick Cage is on it, dare I say it, a little bit of a renaissance at the moment.
Really?
Dog Eat Dog is meant to be, you know, it was well received in Cannes, meant to be batshit crazy. The Trust, even though it went direct to video over here, got good reviews. And I feel he's
kind of turning around. I don't think it did go direct to video, did it?
It did over here. No, went, did it go cinema?
Cinema, yeah.
Cinema 1 week. It went direct to video in the States.
Right.
And it's got good reviews, people saying it actually is quite decent. So maybe he's beginning to turn it around a little bit from the sort of direct to video swill that he's been doing for the last few years.
Yeah, Cage has always been, you know, sort of, shall we say, varied. He kind of sort of dodging around between the awful and the great. So yeah, I mean, but no, that is a one hell of a premise, and it's just great when you can get excited about a film based on nothing other than the fact that you really like the idea inherent in the story, as opposed to it, you know, being the follow up to this thing that you like or the movie version of that thing that you read that you liked.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really think of a time when that's gone poorly, like Snakes on a Plane or any of these things. Yeah. Like, you just hear the premise and you know the movie's going to be amazing, and then it is.
Yeah.
We should do a new story on it every month until it comes out.
We should do, yeah. Because when Snakes on a Plane came out, we were so excited about the film, we did a monthly countdown. Do you remember this, Dan?
Yeah.
In the magazine?
Yeah.
And every month, I think every month I spoke to David R. Ellis, rest his soul, who's the director of the movie. And we focused on a new bit of Snakes in a Plane mania every single issue. Somehow managed to eke it out for like 7 or 8 months because the internet was going batshit crazy. It was one of those very, very instructive moments when you realize when a film comes out, flatlines, and you realize that the internet doesn't necessarily reflect the rest of the movie going populace.
Yeah. I mean, that was a great story of a film as opposed to a great film.
Yeah. Still quite a fun film. In certain places. Yeah. It's got some stuff going for it. Yeah, it's all right. And speaking of, we were talking about how Nick Cage is in a sort of DTV hell at the moment. Bruce Willis has been like that for the last while as well. He's making a lot of very generic, interchangeable action movies with very generic, interchangeable names. So I was intrigued this week to see him team up with Eli Roth for the remake of Death Wish, which has been mooted for years and has had so many directors attached to it. Most recently, of course, Joe Carnahan tried to get it off the ground, and there was talk he might do it with Frank Grillo, but now it seems to be Eli Roth, who seems to be consciously trying to step away, I think, from horror and reinvent himself a little bit. I think his last couple of horror movies, Knock Knock and The Green Inferno, didn't do that well at the box office, so he's trying to maybe step into a different arena.
Yes, because there's nothing horrific at all about a right-wing vigilante fantasy.
Well, it is. If you point out the flaws of that right-wing vigilante fantasy, then you can have a very interesting movie. The interesting thing about, and perhaps the appalling thing about Michael Winner's Death Wish movies, is that they're very clearly on the side of Charles Bronson's Paul Hersey. Death Wish 3 in particular, which is, if you haven't seen Death Wish 3, Death Wish 1 and Death Wish 2 are appalling. They're all appalling films. Mm. But Death Wish 1 and Death Wish 2 are, you know, there's just something really horrible and transgressive about it. And there's really nasty depictions of rape and murder, and it's just, they leave a bad taste in your mouth. Death Wish 3 is an insane film. It's a demented film. It's not a good film by any stretch of imagination, but if you haven't seen it, go and check it out. It's this weird effed up, why did I say effed up? I've just sworn in the podcast. It's, you know, it's just this weird reactionary demented vigilante tale with Bronson at the center of it, and a mad shootout on a roof near the end. It's really weird. Anyway, where were we? Sorry about that. I get sidetracked in these things sometimes. But yeah, you're not a fan of Death Wish, is what you're saying.
No.
Neither am I, that's the thing. But at the same time, this franchise has notoriety and has a certain brand value. And so I'm intrigued to see what someone like Eli Roth, who gets a lot of flack, but each of his movies has a political point and something to say, can do with this subject matter. Plus, I think Bruce Willis needs a strong director. I really do. I think his best performances in the last five, six years or so have come with directors who've been willing to engage with him, or at least try to engage with him, whether it's Wes Anderson in Moonrise Kingdom or Rian Johnson in Looper. Otherwise, most of the time you'll get that phoned-in Bruce Willis. Mm. And I'm hopeful that Eli can engage and find the great actor that is there under the surface.
Well, I think, yeah, certainly, if you have Bruce Willis with a no-mark director doing Death Wish, then, you know, the assumption will be that it'll be garbage. But, and again, yeah, if you have Eli Roth doing it with a caster that doesn't intrigue you either, again, you feel like it'll be an Eli... It'll go the same way as recent Eli Roth films, but this, you know, feels like perhaps there's a reason in the script or whatever for them both doing it and doing it together.
Yeah. And there may also have been a reason why this film has been tough to get made. I mean, it's gone through so many people, and Joe Carnan, you know, maybe not as hot as he once was, but he couldn't get it off the ground. So maybe there's something in that. Maybe there's something. Maybe this film won't get made. It wouldn't be the first time Eli Roth's attached himself to a movie and it not get made. So we shall see. And just very, very quickly before we talk about the tragic news about Anton Yelchin, is news that Noomi Rapace will be in Alien Covenant after all. Apparently she's in Australia right now. She's shooting lots of scenes as Elizabeth Shaw for Alien Covenant, which is interesting. She wasn't announced in the cast at first. Certain reports and rumours we've had is that her character wasn't in the film or isn't in the film or doesn't play a big part in the film, but there she is. Apparently she's on set.
So they didn't replace Rapace?
They didn't Noomi replace her, no. Who knows? Could be intriguing to see what comes of that one.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is the horrible... tragic news that happened on Sunday night when Anton Yelchin, such a wonderful, wonderfully talented and vibrant young actor, just 27 years old, passed away in tragic, horrible circumstances in LA. I won't go into the details of what happened, but just absolutely horrendous news.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he has was the new Chekhov in the Star Trek films, and that's a big thing. But I mean, you know, I got a real sense. Green Room is one of my favourite films I've seen so far this year.
Yeah, it's a great film.
And one of the reasons that film works so well is because of Yelchin's performance in it. He really, really holds it together, and he's really kind of, you know, the audience is, you know, the voice in a way in that film. And I really felt watching that, I thought, okay, this is, I'm feeling a moment starting here. And I'm not just saying that because it's what's happened this week. And was interesting to see how that would move him on, you know. And clearly, it's, you know, that's what's happened has just snatched that potential away from us. So yeah, that's you know, just from that perspective, it's absolutely terrible. But you know, in terms of in Star Trek, I thought he occupied that particular character very well, and I can't actually, you know, there's nothing he's done this, but I actually really liked him in Terminator Salvation. I thought he was really good casting for a young Kyle Reese too. You know, I like what he brought to that movie. So yeah, it's absolutely awful. I mean, as it always is when somebody talented suddenly is, you know, torn away from the world very suddenly and unexpectedly.
Absolutely. He was a really, really, really fascinating actor from a very young age. I mean, I remember seeing him in Hearts of Atlantis. He was very, very good in that. He was in Along Came a Spider, the James Patterson adaptation with Morgan Freeman. He's really, really great in an episode of Criminal Minds, which is a show, obviously, I love, and we'll mention that every opportunity. But he was just one of those people who was very, very solid and very, very good and very likable in a lot of movies, whether it was, you know, Like Crazy or Star Trek or, you know, Charlie Bartlett. Mm. You know, and I think he was a fine fit in the Star Trek universe. And from all reports, I never met him. Did you ever have the pleasure?
Never had the pleasure, no.
Never interviewed him.
But from all reports, people who have interviewed him and who'd worked with him, it was again... fascinating and moving to watch the outpouring of love and emotion for him last week on Twitter from people who had just worked with him, including Jeremy Saulnier, who was, you know, very, very open and honest about their relationship together and said that in a weird way Anton Yelchin had been his mentor, not the other way around. And he was just a very, very likeable, very nice, very inquisitive, intellectually restless guy who, you know, didn't take acting that seriously. And I think the overriding image I'll take away from this week is the image of him on set of a movie shielding a group of ducks as they cross the road with an umbrella. I think, you know, that just sums him up for me in a weird way. But a great talent, and taken from us far, far too soon at the age of 27. Anton Yelchin, who died this week. Okay, so let's have this week's guest on. Independence Day Resurgence opens in the UK this week, and our spoiler special on the film, featuring a long interview with the director Roland Emmerich, will be out next week. All being well, we have yet to record our section of that. The movie stars, of course, the legendary Jeff Goldblum, back as David Levinson. And when he came to London recently, Nick Desemlian had the honour of an audience with the most idiosyncratic, eccentric, capricious, wonderful acting entity on this earth. Enjoy.
We are ecstatic to have Jeff Goldblum on the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
My ecstasy o'erleaps your own. I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. Yeah, it's a very sunny Monday morning.
I know.
It's time to be chatting.
It sure is. It's very nice. I like all kinds of weather, though. I like your foggy days. Do you know that song?
Give us a bit of it.
A foggy day in London town. You don't know it?
I don't.
You're not familiar with it? Well, I feel now responsible for introducing it to you, but you should look it up. And I'll hear it goes a little bit like that. A foggy day in London town had me low, had me down. I viewed the morning with alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wondered, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed, 'cause suddenly I saw you there, Nick, and through foggy London town, the sun was shining everywhere. That's Foggy Day in London Town.
Wow.
Yeah, you'll see. That's my poor version of it, but the lyrics are lovely, aren't they?
Thank you. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
But you'll hear Tony Bennett. You'll hear everybody singing that. That's a lovely song.
And is the British Museum somewhere you go to when you're in London, or what do you get up to?
You know, whatever the my obligation is. You know, I'm rarely here just on a lark. At my own, you know, free scheduling, you know. I mean, what I'm up to now is, you know, talking about this movie, this Independence Day Resurgence, and sitting here with you. But I wouldn't rather be doing anything else than this, and then all of this. It's I'm here touring the press, places with Roland Emmerich. Roland Emmerich, the director, who's a brilliant, wonderful director, who did the first one, who did this one too, and a good friend. He's a delightful model of a human being. And with Liam Hemsworth, a fine actor. We shared a lot of laughs and a great time making it, and we're hanging out doing this.
Yeah.
And he's a great, great character too. Perfect for these kinds of parts. He's a deeply decent man. And very gifted and fun to hang out with.
It's a very exciting month for us because you're on the cover of Empire for the first time since The Lost World.
I was on the cover.
You were
on
the cover
World?
With some velociraptors, and now here you are again with a.
I remember that cover. Yeah. Well, it's a great honor, boy. Oh boy, and that's a heck of a nice looking picture.
You're getting kind of up close and personal with a xenomorph.
With a what?
A xenomorph, an alien.
A xenomorph?
Xenomorph.
Xenomorph.
I believe that's the term.
I'd never heard that in my life. Where do you get that from?
From the Alien movies, I think.
Xenomorph. Oh, the Alien movies? They call them xenomorph? I wonder what's the derivation of that.
Yeah.
But there I am, yes. But looking unflappable. Look, I'm just looking at you, the camera, as if this thing doesn't bother me. I hope this guy knows what he's getting in for, because I'm about to snap these tentacles and use them as a whip against him and give him the old 1-2. That's right. I look pretty tough in there, don't I?
It's pretty great. It's pretty great.
Thanks for doing that.
No problem. And it got me thinking that you have only, this is only your second sequel, as far as I know.
Wait,
and you've
minute.
Been on the cover both times for a sequel. So
hey, I'm a sequel.
You're
hey,
a sequel
sequels
guy.
Are good for me so far. Well, good.
And was Independence Day Resurgence, what is it? Was it better the second time around?
Lie Independence Day is so much better the second time around. Yes. Yes, of course it was. I mean, it was lovely the first time. It would have been, and if nothing had ever happened besides shooting it, it would have been a delightful dream come true and a great experience. But then people liked it and da 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 da, and they've been showing it. And Roland Emmerich was encouraged to make the second one along with Dean Devlin. And I couldn't be more thrilled. And yeah, I think it was better. I'll tell you, working with Bill Pullman, I spent more quality time with him, and maybe something in me was more available to enjoy him and appreciate him more, as well as my dad, played by Judd Hirsch. Brent Spiner, delightful. Celia Ward, of course, is the first female American president. I love that character. It was great spending time with her. We're going to go to Mexico City together to do some press. That'll be fun. We were at the White House Correspondents' Dinner together, me with my wife and her with her husband. We met Barack Obama. I love him. So there are perks to this whole little tour. Can you imagine? And then the new people in the cast, like Liam Hemsworth, a great, great man, of course, and a fine actor, and a decent fellow to his core, decent, a model of decency and character. And I did scenes with Charlotte Gainsbourg. You know her?
Yeah. I like her music.
Oh, she's a great musician and a great actress and a great artiste and a great person. Have you ever met her?
I've not, no.
She's in town just for today. She flew in. Then she's going back to New York. But boy, I sure felt grateful to work with her. What a wonderful, wonderful person she is.
Yeah, no, it's an exciting cast. And I believe this is your first time in a spacesuit in a movie. Am I right?
Hey, you're right. I mean, you'd have to have done your homework, but I believe you're right. I don't think I've ever put on a moon, like an astronaut's outfit. If that's probably not what you call it, but whatever it was, I had one of those on with Liam Hemsworth. We were floating around in those things for a few days. What do you think of that? And they the production, which was very big, spent $150,000. I don't know what that is in pounds these days. I don't know if people would know what dollars are. That's what we use in America for currency. We call our money dollars. $150,000 of them per suit. That's a hell of a suit. You've never had a suit more than
$5.
$5. No, you're a natty guy. I doubt that. But how about that? But as much as they spent on them, they were, I don't mean to complain, but they were a little heavy and hot and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But anyway, we did our best. But I like being an astronaut. How about that?
I got a few sort of random quickfire questions.
Oh, yeah, I like that. I like random and I like quick.
Did you get to keep your chopped off fingers from the movie Grand Budapest Hotel?
I did not, nor did I ask. We were just talking to Lauren, our wonderful publicist, my friend here. We were talking. I'm not a saver of things and a memorabiliaist, if that's a word. So I didn't keep those. But that was a neat trick that they did. That Willem Dafoe, that guy, he chopped him off, didn't he? Well, we've had a couple of run-ins in a couple of movies. Yeah, he chopped my fingers off. Yeah, how about that? Okay, next question.
Okay, next question. You and I both pop up in Jurassic World because I was an extra in that movie. I lose no opportunity to brag about it. And you popped up because your face was on a book. Did you know that was going to happen when you saw it?
They called me before and said, may we do this? I think they asked permission. I said, most certainly. Mm. I'd be greatly honored if I were on a book in that movie. Yes.
Yeah. Do you have a copy of that book? Did they send you one?
No,
that would be a
they didn't. No. Yeah. You know, like I say, I don't keep things, but you know, that would be a cherished object. What did you play? You were an extra?
I was in a crowd scene. You would not spot me.
But still, the camera didn't follow you for a couple hours, but you must have come up with a whole character. Any even extra could be the star of their own movie. What was your story?
In my mind, well, the director Colin actually came up with a backstory for me and a name.
What
Edmund.
What were you? What
I was
you?
Edmund, an unlucky British tourist. But let's not waste our time talking about.
I love that. Okay, well, I'm gonna look it up. That's good.
You had a very small part in Death Wish.
I did. It was my first movie ever. Long before you were born, 1973. I played Freak Number One.
Did you come up with a backstory for Freak Number One, as I did with Edmund?
I might have, you know. Yeah, I might have. I'm not a formulaic kind of. I'm nothing if not conscientious. I prepare, but you know, detailing a whole backstory sometimes is useful to me and sometimes not. Anyway, that was my first thing, and I was a humble student, as I still am, and I was learning. I was a seed. I was a little mustard seed at that point. I don't know what I did.
How was Michael Winner?
Michael Winner. He gave me a fantastic piece of direction. He was known as a yeller and a screamer, and he screamed at me the first time I ever had him shot in a movie. I was rehearsing, so-called. I didn't know what that was, really, and the camera was following me, practicing its move as we were skulking up the stairs, and he said, "Goldblum, start acting now!" He screamed at me, and it shook me up. But, you know, the more I've thought about it over these last four decades, I think it's a very good...
A good bit of direction.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to teach acting, and I'm a kind of a craft geek. But, you know, really, it boils down to start acting now. That's kind of all there is to say, really.
Yeah. Independence Day Resurgent has the most terrifying alien invasion since Earth Girls Are Easy.
Yes, which, that was me who invaded. That's right. Thank
so,
you.
How was that experience?
Delightful. Julian Temple, a very hip, sophisticated director, had done Absolute Beginners before that and showed us, speaking of movies that he educated me with before the fact as homework, was The Girl Can't Help It, that he thought was kind of in the vein and tone. Do you know that movie?
I've not seen that one.
No, you should look that up. Boy, is that something. The Girl Can't Help It. The Girl Can't Help It. It's a kind of a musical, and it's colorful and kind of, it's good. Anyway, yeah, he was great. And how was that? Yeah, it was great. I loved the whole experience, and, you know, I was blue. They painted me, and it was fun. Jim Carrey was in that, of course, and yeah, fun.
And you're going to be blue. In this is a good segue.
Yeah.
In Thor Ragnarok.
That's an excellent segue. And you're wearing blue, so you're in your blue period.
Just to ask that question.
You look like a Picasso painting. If you had a guitar and you were in a droopy, you know, kind of plastique.
It's not because one of my eyes is higher than the other one.
But I know who you look like. I'm good at this game. You would be a young Keanu Reeves. Handsome Keanu Reeves.
I'll take it. Thank
Don't you.
You
have people said you look like him before?
That has never happened, but well, thank you very much.
I think you do. I think that's a good one.
I've been told Ross from Friends, but never Keanu.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, or David Schwimmer from Friends.
Ross. Yeah.
Oh, boy, I should have watched that more and study up on my friends. But your question was blue. Yeah, I'm going to be in that Thor Ragnarok movie that I love, that director, Taika Waititi, who did created with Jermaine Clement the Flight of the Conchords and did What We Do in the Shadows, which is very good.
And his new one has Sam Neill in it, so it's a bit of a, you know.
I want to see that. That's the last one he did. I hear great things about that, and I had a meeting with him. I love him, and boy, good actors in that movie. Not only Chris Hemsworth, I love all those Hemsworths and their parents I met. What a great family. Good stock, and Cate Blanchett, Anthony Hopkins. My golly. Jeez, that's going to be fun. And Australia. I've never been there except to do these little publicity things. We just came back from there, Sydney, you know, but I'll be in Brisbane for 3 weeks or a month, and Emily and Charlie Ocean will join me.
And what's exciting about the Grandmaster for you? Because he's a kind of a playful eldritch. Yeah, you're doing a kind of thing with your hand, which implies
I'm
that
already,
he's...
Well, I'm doing what you're doing. I'm already taking my cue from you, because you probably know more about the Grandmaster than I do. But I'm a sponge. At this point, I'm researching. But yes, playful. I could do that. I could do something playful. And he's a pleasure, hedonist, a kind of a pleasure seeker and enjoyer of life and tastes and smells. And so I can do that, I'll bet. And yeah, I'm working on my part every day. I am.
What are you doing for research? Because you're kind of famous for your very in-depth. For The Fly, you actually caught a fly.
Yeah, I don't know if that should make me famous, but anybody would have done the same thing. I looked at a fly. I was supposed to play the fly, and I looked at a fly and saw how the fly moved around and took a little information from that, I think. Well, I'm studying the script and my part. Mostly I'm figuring out how I'm practicing my lines, and he's encouraged me to improvise and kind of make it my own, so to speak. So I'm kind of evolving and tweaking sort of my version of it. I hope he doesn't kick me out on the first day. You know?
Amazing. All right, Jeff Goldblum, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. And for calling me Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves, I'll take it.
Are you spitting image? Yeah.
I'll pay you later.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
So that was Jeff Goldblum with Nick Desimlian. Very, very jealous once again of Nick. Oh, man. 20 minutes of Jeff Goldblum. What I wouldn't give. Hang on, that sounds weird. So let's kick off the review section with Independence Day Resurgence. Interesting sort of spectrum of opinions in this room. But let's start with Dan Jolin.
I got the official one.
Who wrote the official Empire Review.
Independence Day.
Independence Dan.
Dan Surgeons. Dan.
Set the scene. What is this movie?
Set the scene. So 20 years on, because it is 20 years on. It's actually 20 years on for us, right? Yeah.
From
Independence Day, the attack by the unnamed aliens, the locusts, the harvesters, which is weird because it makes me think of a shit restaurant.
Which came after Euro 2000 and Euro 96.
You're right.
It just came after that.
You're right.
Yeah.
It did. So Independence Day, great fun, huge box office hit, made the career of Roland Emmerich. 20 years on.
And you could argue Will Smith.
And Will Smith. Yes, you can argue Will Smith. Mm-hmm. So it's 20 years on for us, and it's back. But in their world, it's quite different. In the world of Independence Day, we start, and everything's different from what we know. For a start, you know, there's been world peace for 20 years. Yes. I mean, you know, that's great. You know, because the only thing that would bring the world together would be an alien attack, many people believe. But we've also got the technology of the aliens as well. So it's a funny one. It starts off like almost like a pure sci-fi film. You know, Earth in 2016 in that world is a very different place. But those aliens are coming back, and they come back, and they come back with a bigger spaceship. It's 3,000 miles in diameter, this thing. And it swoops down on Earth.
Yes.
It has its own gravity around it.
It does.
I'm sure that because science. And and it swoops down and it plucks up. It goes over. It picks up half of Asia and dumps it on Europe.
London, to be precise.
Yeah, London. We get the Burj Khalifa up our wazoo.
The ultimate Brexit.
Yes. Let's not go there. And so this is Roland Emmerich. Just going back to that thing that made his career and just having a ball. Just having a great time. And he's never taking it too seriously. I mean, okay, there's some points there about, you know, world unity and the things that divide us. And it's got some ideas in it about the different generations. There's a generation which just... Jeff Goldblum, obviously, is part of, and Bill Pullman, who's back as President Whitmore, although he's very damaged by having the aliens inside his head briefly all those years ago.
Only interesting character in the film.
Look, you can have your say in a minute. All right? Let me finish. And so you've got that older generation, then there's the younger generation, the generation of orphans, the people that lost their parents and that you know, grew up expecting this return, kind of a very mobilised society. Uh-huh. So there's all these ideas in it, but really, you're just watching it just to see how big and silly, and yes, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, there's one bit where Goldblum basically looks to camera and delivers a zinger, and it ends with the audience being directly addressed by a character as well, just basically, you know, putting their hands up in the air and, you know, this is not a spoiler, and shouting something basically to the audience. Emmerich knows his crowd, and he's here to please them. So let's not take it too seriously. Let's just go along, party like it's 1996.
Oh, because were standards for movies much lower back then? Is that why we're accepting this?
No.
Okay.
It's just. I'm
just curious.
It was a good time. It was a fun time. It was fun times.
We're gonna hash it out properly. I'm not gonna pollute this with my opinions about this dreadful film too much. I'm gonna leave it to you. Official Empire Review. In fairness, I'm the only one in the office who doesn't like this movie. Everyone else came out, spread smiles on their faces. 3 stars Johnny, 4 stars Dan, other people 4, other people 3. This is fine, it's okay. We'll hash it out in the spoiler special, then I will air all my grievances with this movie. We'll have a good old chunk of time. It'll be fine. Johnny, what did you think?
I thought it was 3. Basically, I think the first one is a 4, and I don't think this one is as good as that. So that makes it, but I still think it's a good film. So I think it's a 3. I don't think the setup is quite as effective, but I think Independence Day, actually the first 30 minutes to 45 minutes are impeccable. That building of tension, and then suddenly you have that big release as the White House gets hit, and the US Bank Tower and the Empire State Building, they all go, and I think that's wonderful. And you don't get the same kind of thing, because there's another alien thing that comes in, a big white floaty ball thing, and it's never entirely as clear cut what's going on.
Yeah.
And then there's a weird thing in a paddy field in the alien ship. So things are stranger this time round. Things aren't quite as pure.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good time. I would recommend people went to see. In fact, I would recommend that they watch the first one to refresh themselves, and then went to see this one and just had a nice time at the cinema.
I did that actually. I watched Independence Day like the week before.
Okay.
Before I knew I was going to see this, so I just thought, let's, you know, set myself up. And I totally actually agree with that point that you just made, Johnny, which is it's in my review about the build up not being as good. I mean, part of it is you're watching a different world to start with. You're not watching your own world. So you kind of lose that sort of element of familiarity.
But they have that weird nod to familiarity where they have seemingly rebuilt entire cities down to 1996 specifications. So London, which gets destroyed in the first movie, is just there, rebuilt with the London Eye as well, which is intriguing. And they rebuild Washington with the White House. I thought this was a clumsily written and clumsily made movie. I thought that I'll get into it in the spoiler special, but I don't agree with I do agree with you, because I think the build up is clumsy. I think the spaceship just arrives and it's meant to be a big gotcha moment, and it's just a little bit anticlimactic. But it's interesting the way he decides to move away from the uber destruction that he has, you know, obviously he pioneered in Independence Day, and then with The Day After Tomorrow and 2012 and Godzilla, he felt, I've taken it as far as I can take it, so we're going to do something else. And he does do something different with this movie. I just didn't think he did it very well. I will explain all, in my opinion, on the spoiler special when we do it next week.
I think the three big returning characters, which are Jeff Goldblum's character, Bill Pullman's, and Brent Spiner's, actually.
Weirdly enough.
But I think they're all great value when they're on screen, and so often it's the case with these films that it's the new guys who come in who aren't quite as compelling.
Yeah.
But when those three are on screen in any sort of, whether it's two of them together, just one of them, whatever it might be, I think they're always entertaining.
I like Goldblum a lot. I do think that Whitmore is the only interesting character in the film. He has he's an interesting arc. They try and do something different with him. He's suffering from a massive case of PTSD, as you might imagine. If you remember the first film, his brain was hijacked by alien intelligence. So you can understand that. I think Bill Pullman is very good in the film. And Brent Spiner has a very... I like what they do with him. We'll get into it another time as well. But you're right. The main leads, so Liam Hemsworth, Jesse T. Usher, and Micah Monroe, sadly are saddled with really bland characters. If you remember the first Independence Day, even then, all the supporting cast had quirks and stuff and something to do, and they were memorable. Whether it was, you know, Judd Hirsch or Harvey Fierstein or Margaret Cullen, they all had. Minimal screen time, but they made maximum impact. And Don't forget Randy Quaid. How can I forget Randy Quaid flying his plane of the Star Wackers bums? Yeah. How can I forget that?
It's a shame that one of his children actually wasn't one of the you know young adult characters.
Yeah.
In this.
But that would have involved writing the second draft. So.
Ooh.
Burn. Anyway. So there we go. I didn't think it worked really at all on pretty much any level, but.
You see, you're saying things, I know what you're saying, and I understand what you're saying, and I sympathise with what you're saying, and these were all my reservations, but sometimes you just enjoy that kind of, that warm rush of just watching a big, silly film, and it's just,
it's fun.
It's been a bad summer, and I thought this was...
Dan and I took a lot of sweets into that film.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Sugar Rush.
Maybe that
was
helps.
A bit of a sugar rush. But have you rewatched the first film recently?
Last year when I went on set.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe I was, it's when you're reviewing a film, there's so many different factors. You know, you might, for example, if I reviewed a film today, whatever it is, it couldn't get more than 2 stars, right?
Whoa! Can we cut that bit?
That was a joke.
Was it?
That was a joke.
Was it?
That was a joke about my mood today. But no, sometimes you get little factors that come into play. And I'd seen the first film quite recently, and I thought it just felt like a great tribute to that and a great continuation of that. And I think that certainly buoyed me.
Boy, do you indeed. All right, so 4 stars for Independence Day. Resurgence, which is, of course, we always say in the Empire podcast, an uber recommendation. Do we say that in the Empire podcast? I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, Roland Emmerich is German, so perhaps, you know.
Maybe it is. So there we go, 4 stars. And I will be seeing it again this weekend, hopefully.
Oh, cool.
Euro 2016 games, notwithstanding. Next up, Secret Life of Pets.
Oh, I did that.
Johnny, you wrote the review.
I did.
This is amazing. Oh, serendipitous. Okay, yes, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, so it's an animation. It's from the people who unleash minions on the world in their various original films and then the spin-off and their little shorts. Mm. And so you do get a Minions short beforehand where they
very funny one.
Do some gardening. Yeah. Oh, you've seen it as
I've
well?
I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, it was all right.
I liked it. There's a poo joke. It had me.
Yeah, so 5 stars for that.
5 stars for, was it Minion Mower? Mower Minion? Something like that. I wrote it down
in my book and then never mentioned it again.
Yeah, I don't remember it, but yeah, it's quite funny. And then the actual movie, Secret Life of Pets, is...
Don't remember it.
Don't remember it at all. It's about the Secret Life of Pets, isn't it?
Yeah, something about that.
Yeah.
So there is, yeah, there's a dog. He's voiced by Louis C.K. And he... you know, lives a lovely life in a New York apartment block. He has pals who happen to be other dogs and cats and a, I think, guinea pig that's running around the vents.
Yeah, it's a guinea pig, yeah.
And then one day, his owner brings back a big mongrelly dog, possibly a mongrel, possibly a dog that I don't know the breed of. And but it's a disaster for him. You know, he doesn't isn't able to sleep in his bed anymore. Mm-hmm. This dog eats his food. They don't get on at all. Mm. And events conspire, and eventually the two of them get lost in New York together, and they have to try and find their way home. Meanwhile, their friends go out to search for them. And there's also a group of very evil, abandoned, flushed... They're called the Flush Pets, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they want to kill them for some reason.
Yeah, because they want to take over the world, essentially, don't they? So they're led by Kevin Hart's bunny rabbit, who's missing a tooth, and he's a bit psychotic, and there's a crocodile in there, and loads of snakes, and all sorts. And so eventually they may... come together, these three desperate groups, as they try and get across a rather lovely animated New York.
It is beautiful. It's really nice. It's you just like sit and look at that cityscape, and it's nicer than the real one.
It is nicer than the real one, yeah.
Very shiny, shiny. I love a shine. But the film is very familiar, I thought, as I was watching it. I mean, if they weren't pets, if they were, I don't know, let's say toys, then it would be... I mean, it's almost exactly the same as the first Toy Story.
Yeah.
Louis C.K.'s character Max is Woody. Mm-hmm. The big mongrelly dog thing is Buzz, and then they have all these people around it, and then they have what's the kid who lives next door called?
Sid.
Sid is the little rabbit, and there you go.
Absolutely.
And it does feel very familiar all the way through.
It's elements of 2 and 3 in there as well, right? I mean,
No. No.
Sounds just what you're saying.
No, just what I'm afraid.
this is I thought this is as by the numbers an animated movie as you can get. I enjoyed it. It's quite fun at times, but it's never hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, the people behind it, I mean, it's actually got a wonderful voice cast. I mean, possibly one of the best, like, throughout the cast as you keep on going through it. Ellie Kemper's got a very small role in it. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, and, you know, I think it actually is, you know, very snappily written, and they are, you know, always amusing in it. Mm. But it does have this layer of familiarity where you're like, oh, I've seen that. I mean, I wrote it in the review, but I mean, that cute bunny who happens to be psychotic and evil, you know, we've seen that thing before with most famously with actually another white bunny in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I mean, that's the same joke. There's a set piece which is the same set piece as the trailer hanging off a cliff in The Lost World Jurassic Park, where all the glass is breaking. That's in there.
Yeah.
And it just, because it's such a, it's a well-written script, and it has great voice cast, and you just really wish that they had something more interesting and exciting to do.
Yeah, agreed. Really good cast. Eric Stone Street and Louis C.K., as we mentioned, Jenny Slate. And I just kept wanting it to be something more. I kept wanting something better, funnier lines and funnier situations. But you know, as it is, it's a perfectly passable animated movie.
Yeah, I was always entertained, but absolutely. I was ever so slightly disappointed as well.
It ain't Finding Dory, but it'll do until Finding Dory gets here.
Exactly. Yeah.
So three stars for Secret Life of Pets. And we're going to finish off the reviews section with a 4-star belter, which is Adult Life Skills, a film I have not yet seen, but I really want to, and Johnny will tell you why.
I saw that as well.
Hey!
Yeah.
See, we don't just throw this together. We got the guy who wrote the review and the guy who wrote the reviews. It's all good.
Adult Life Skills is a film set in Northern England, mm-hmm. Near from where I'm from, actually.
Are mm-hmm. you from Northern England?
Yeah.
Wow. I never knew.
So it was instantly I felt at home in this film. And it's about a woman who's approaching 30 and she has lost her twin brother about 15 months before the film is set. She's not dealing with it very well. She has moved into her mother's garden shed and is basically doesn't want a birthday party, is grieving and continuing to grieve. And into this world, she is thrown together with her 8-year-old neighbour who lives next door. And he is struggling with... his mother has terminal cancer as well. Mm. So, I mean, this film sounds depressing as hell, but it isn't. And it's a lovely, sweet, whimsical comedy drama. There are very sad moments in it because you can't deal with talking about, death and grief without that happening. Mm. But these two come together and start to... help each other through this difficult time in their life. Mm. It's a lovely film. It's very, very fun. It's well acted, and the laughs and the tears are balanced really well.
Okay, fantastic. I can't wait to see it. Jodie Whittaker, big fan of hers. Brett Goldstein is great also. So yeah, fantastic. Right up my alley, it seems. 4 stars for Adult Life Skills. And that's all the movies we're going to review in depth this week. Elvis and Nixon stars Kevin Spacey and Michael Shannon as perhaps the least Elvis-y Elvis in the history of cinema is also out this week. We gave it 3 stars, which of course is a recommendation. So if you do fancy some Elvis and Nixon action, then highly long to your nearest cinema.
I just can't picture Kevin Spacey as an evil president. I just can't.
You're so disappointed we didn't review it. You've been sitting on that line, haven't you? Just been waiting. Waiting to get it in.
Yeah, and I never got the headline President Evil into the mag, which
really
is a lifelong regret.
Well, there you go. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. There's a couple of Empire Podcast specials that are out there right now for your listening pleasure. There is the Warcraft Spoiler Special, which is just an interview with Duncan Jones. Dan talked to Duncan Jones for ages. There's not a section where there's a bunch of idiots like us talking about it. It's just Duncan Jones. It's a pure experience. It's extraordinary. It's amazing.
Our most popular podcast in China ever, I believe.
It's huge. That went up this week, as indeed did a podcast discussing a big feature in the current issue of Empire, the ones on sale right now, where we discuss the 50 greatest sci-fi moments of all time. That's a very fun podcast, so check that out if you like. And of course, join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Elle Fanning and Nicholas Winding Refn, who will be here to talk about the Neon Demon. All very, very exciting. Until then, it is goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Johnny.
Goodbye. And sorry, I've just been thrown by Dan's goodbye.
It was a hell of a goodbye.
Goodbye.
A hell of a goodbye. And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to watch Last Brexit to Brooklyn. See you next week.